Hello, welcome once again to Leto's Law. I'm Steve Leto. Today we're going to talk about old laws. And you know, once in a while you go on the internet, you talk to people about laws and they say, well, you know, our laws go back to the Constitution. Some people say, well, you know, but they really go back to the Articles of Confederation if you want to talk about the early laws in America. And you've got colonial laws and you can back up even further to, like, say, the Magna Carta. And a lot of people like to talk about the Magna Carta because, of course, the Magna Carta was the first expression of the rights of the people in writing, as recognized by a monarch Western society. But I like to go back to the Code of Hammurabi. So whenever I'm talking to somebody about the laws, and they say, Steve, let's talk about old laws and what old laws have to say, I always say, well, are you familiar with the Code of Hammurabi? And many people aren't, but you know, I'm a historian as well as a lawyer, and I'm fascinated by old laws. And so I actually am fascinated by the Code of Hammurabi, which is often regarded as the first set of laws where somebody sat down and said, here are the laws. They're written. Everyone can study them. You will know in advance if you're breaking the law. And also it codifies, it puts in writing what our society considers to be wrong and also how we take care of somebody who's been wronged. How do you punish somebody who was wronged, but also how do you compensate the victims and so on? So the Code of Hammurabi is actually very interesting, but I find it fascinating on several levels. So in case you're curious, Hammurabi himself was the sixth king of Babylonia, and he ruled sometime around 1700 BCE. So this is a while back, but they found copies of this, I believe, carved in stone. And the great thing, of course, is that we have our laws, and they often have the little preambles or a preface that explains what the law does, what the law's purpose is, or possibly even what the justification for the law is. But back then, when you're a king, you get to, you know, make up the justifications pretty much because you're king, which is part of, you know, what's cool about being king. But also, you explain how you're king because of divine right. So the beginning of the Code of Hammurabi's got this preamble, which is one of the greatest things ever written. When Anu the Sublime, king of the Anunnaki, and Bel, the lord of heaven and earth, who decreed the fate of the land, assigned to Marduk, the overruling son of Ea, god of righteousness, dominion over earthly man, and made him great among the Igigi, they called Babylon by his illustrious name, made it great on earth, and founded an everlasting kingdom in it, whose foundations are laid so solidly as those of heaven and earth, then Anu and Bel called by name me, Hammurabi, the exalted prince who feared God to bring about the rule of righteousness in the land, to destroy the wicked and the evildoers so that the strong should not harm the weak, so that I should rule over the black-headed people like Shamash and enlighten the land to further the well-being of mankind. You think, wow, that's a great preamble. Yeah, that's the first paragraph, about six or seven. This guy thought a lot of himself. But you'll notice there's an interesting concept in here that I suspect was actually unusual for the time. And he says that among the goals of things he was told are part of his job on earth as king is that to make sure that the strong should not harm the weak. And that's the kind of thing, you know, this merciful king, that it's interesting to see that in writing and see that that was in essence something, theoretically at least, that Babylonians could count on, is that the weak would be protected from the strong by the king or by the government. So Hammurabi's Code is a collection of laws, and I'm going to be using the translation by L.W. King because these were not written in English. They were written in Babylonian. And the Code of Hammurabi contains 282 laws or rules. Now, we're not going to read them all. It takes some time. But it's just interesting to take a look at them to see what kinds of things they worried about in Babylonia or Babylon back then. I keep saying Babylonian. I think I got that from the Steve Martin song. Number one, if anyone accuses another of murder but cannot prove it, then the accuser shall be put to death. Now, here's the interesting thing. That's the number one accusation. It's the number one rule here, is that this accusation, if you accuse somebody of killing somebody, then you will be put to death if you can't prove it. And so you're going to find that a lot of these things, I don't think they had prisons back then. I think it's kind of like, oh, you're guilty, boom, you're dead. So a lot of these have death as a punishment. Not all of them. I'll explain some more to you later on, but death is apparently the big hammer that Hammurabi's hanging over the heads of the people in his kingdom. But here, let's go on. Number two, if anyone accuses someone else of sorcery, the accused shall leap into the river. Now, this is interesting on a couple levels. Number one, the idea of going and jumping into a river is often used as a joke insult, or take a flying leap. And so you might recognize that. But the second thought is, wait a second. Even as late as the colonial days, we talked about throwing witches into water to see if they'd float. It goes back to the Code of Hammurabi. Number two, if anyone accuses someone else of sorcery, the accused shall leap into the river. And if he or she drowns, the accuser shall take possession of the accused's house and belongings. However, if the accused reaches the shore unharmed and the river thus proves that the accused is innocent of the charges, then the accuser shall be put to death, while the one who leapt into the river shall take possession of the house and belongings of the accuser. So this is one of those interesting things, and I honestly think that this code could have been written by somebody who didn't even believe in sorcery. But they're basically saying, look, it's like a lie detector. You don't have to actually have a lie detector that works. Half the time you ask them to take it and they refuse, you know they're lying to you. Well, likewise, the river is the Hammurabian lie detector, okay? So I say, hey, look, if you want to accuse somebody of sorcery, if they can jump in that river and get out under their own power, that proves they're not a sorcerer, you'll be put to death. It'll make you really rethink whether you want to accuse somebody of sorcery, depending on the river. Number three, if anyone brings an accusation that involves a capital murder charge and does not prove what he is charged, the accuser shall be put to death. So I'm getting the impression that in Babylon, there are a lot of people accusing each other of bad stuff. That guy's a witch. That guy killed somebody. Over there, that guy, I think, also killed somebody. Maybe he killed a witch. Problem, of course, is a lot of these things have very, very severe ramifications. And Hammurabi didn't want to have any of it. Number five, and this is an interesting one. If a judge tries a case, reaches a decision, and presents his judgment in writing, but later an error is found that is the judge's own fault, the judge must pay 12 times the fine. In addition, he should be publicly removed from the judge's bench and never again sit on the bench nor render judgment. Can you imagine that? If a judge makes a mistake and you can prove it's his fault, number one, he pays you 12 times the damages. Number two, he's kicked off the bench. Number three, he can never return to the bench. I can't tell you how many judges out there have never, ever made a mistake that was their fault. It's a number approaching zero. If anyone steals anything from the temple or the court, he will be put to death. And also, the one who has received the stolen goods will be put to death. So, again, theft is bad. Don't steal from the king or the temple. And by the way, if you get into possession of those goods, get rid of them or give them back, because you might be put to death as well. And I'm going to start jumping around here now, because a lot of this stuff is kind of repetitive. But for instance, if anyone breaks into a house to steal at number 21, he'll be put to death before that point of entry and be buried there. So in other words, if someone breaks into your house and you catch them and they're guilty of it, they'll be put to death and buried on the spot. So if you've got a house that's popular with burglars, you might have burglars buried around your yard eventually. Kind of a strange concept, but apparently they thought that would help deter burglars. I mean, maybe you put up a headstone. Last guy who broke in, buried here. Number 22, if anyone is caught while committing a robbery, they should be put to death. Boom, that death thing. It's very popular with Mr. Hammurabi. If fire breaks out in a house and someone who comes to help put it out casts his eye upon the property of the owner of the house and then steals the property of the master of the house, you know, looting, he shall be thrown into the fire. So in other words, it's not necessarily a death sentence, but if you catch somebody who shows up at the scene of the fire and instead of putting the fire out, they're stealing stuff, you can pick them up and throw them in the fire. Seems fitting, right? There's a whole bunch of things in here about what happens if you go off to war. and people presume that you're dead. You never come back. But then a couple years later, you do come back. Turns out you were just gone for a while. What happens to your property? So if a chieftain or a man leaves his house, garden, and field and hires it out, and this is one where he actually said, look, I'm going away for a little while. I'm going to rent this to you. And someone else takes possession of his house, garden, and field and uses it for 3 years. If the first owner returns and claims his house, garden, and field, it shall not be given to him, but he who has taken possession of it and used it shall continue to use it after 3 years. Remember adverse possession? There you have it. Adverse possession, 1700 years BCE. And that's only 3 years. If anyone owes a debt for a loan, this is number 48. We're getting into the banking laws of Babylon. If anyone owes a debt for a loan and a storm wipes out the grain or the harvest fails, or the grain does not grow for lack of water, in that year he need not give his creditor any grain in payment. He washes his debt tablet in water and pays no rent for the year. So you got one bad year, guess what? The people you owe money to have got to ride it out for another year so you can pay them back. But that, of course, is assuming the storm wiped out your grain, your harvest failed, or you had a lack of water causing your grain to not grow. Here's one for you, 53. If anyone is too lazy to keep his dam in proper condition and the dam then breaks and the fields get flooded, whoever let the dam break shall be sold for money, enslaved, and the money shall replace the crops, which is caused to be ruined. So if you are the keeper of a dam, you better take care of it. Because if, due to your laziness, it fails, you could get sold into slavery. 109, if outlaws meet in a tavern and are not captured and are delivered to the court or palace, the female tavern keeper shall be put to death. Interestingly, it doesn't say she has to have knowledge of these people being outlaws. But if outlaws simply took refuge in a tavern and then later on were captured someplace else, the female tavern keeper shall be put to death. Again, a little harsh, but again, pretty much you get death for everything in Babylon. If a holy woman opens a tavern door or enters a tavern for a drink, she'll be burned to death. Now, it's interesting because the previous ones don't say the method of death. It just simply says you'll be put to death. But here they specifically say a holy woman opening a tavern door or entering a tavern for a drink shall be burned to death. So very, very specific there for the holy woman. Jump down some more at number 127. If anyone points the finger, accuses another of adultery, of a holy woman or someone else's wife, but cannot prove it, this man, the accuser, shall be taken before the judges, and his brow shall be marked by cutting his skin or perhaps cutting off his hair. So they'll actually shave your head or scar you because you have inappropriately accused somebody else of adultery. 128, if a man takes a woman to be his wife but has no intercourse with her or does not draw up a marriage contract, this woman is no wife to him. Interestingly, no one's put to death there. That's one of the happier codes of Hammurabi. 130. If a man violates the wife of another man who is still a virgin living in her father's house and gets caught in the act, the man shall be put to death. But the wife is blameless, interestingly enough. So the man's put to death. But the betrothed wife is not. If the finger is pointed at a man's wife about another man accused of adultery, but she is not caught sleeping with the other man, it's just an accusation but no evidence, she shall jump into the river for her husband's sake. Presumably, if she can get out of the river, she's innocent. If she can't get out of the river, she's the same fate as the sorcerers who have been proven guilty by the river itself. 137, if a man wishes to separate from a woman who has borne him children, or from his wife who has borne him children, then he shall give that wife her dowry and a part of the field, garden, and property so that she can rear her children. When she's brought up her children, a portion of all that is given to the children, equal as that of one son, shall be given to her. She may then marry the man of her heart. This is fascinating stuff because here the law actually talks about what happens when you have a divorce or a separation. This, you know, till death do us part stuff, not in Babylon. But number two, the property settlement she gets. And number three, she may marry the man of her heart. And people often think that, you know, this romantic marriage thing was invented by, like, you know, rom-coms in Hollywood or, like, you know, 21st century Americans. But in reality, she may marry the man of her heart is from 1750 BC Babylon. 146, if a man takes a wife and she gives this man a maidservant as a child bearer, and the maidservant does bear him children, then his maid assumes equality with the wife because she's borne him children. Her master shall not sell her for money, but he may keep her as a slave, reckoning her among the maidservants. You know, some of this stuff is probably outdated by now. But if a man takes a wife and she is seized by disease, if he then desires to take a second wife, he shall not put away the first wife, but he shall keep her in the house which he's built and support her so long as she lives. Seems fair. If the wife of one man on account of another man has the spouses or her husband murdered, both the wife and her lover shall be impaled on stakes. I suspect that's a death sentence. So we have three causes of death here. We have the one indeterminate, just be put to death. Number two, we have them being thrown into the river and not getting out. Number three, we've got the people being thrown into the fire. And number four, we now have them being impaled on stakes. 192, if an adopted son says to his adoptive father or mother, "You are not my father or my mother," his tongue shall be cut out. We believe in the family relationship very strongly here in the land of Hammurabi. If a son strikes his father, his hands shall be cut off. Okay, let's talk about some family discipline, my friend. If a man put out the eye of a nobleman, his eye shall be put out. Many people believe that's where an eye for an eye came from, because later on, at 200, if a man knocks out the tooth of his equal, his teeth should be knocked out, tooth for a tooth. If during a quarrel, at 206, one man strikes another and wounds him, then he shall swear, "I did not injure him on purpose." And if he swears to that, all he has to pay is the medical bills. I kid you not, he'll pay the physicians. So we've got some, you know, civil remedies here. If a physician performs an operation and kills someone or cuts out his eye, the doctor's hands shall be cut off. It's an early medieval form of medical malpractice. If a physician performs an operation on the slave of a freedman and kills him, the doctor shall replace the slave with another. And finally, if it ruins goods, he shall make compensation for all that has been ruined. And we're talking about a builder. A man who builds a house but not construct it properly. At 232, if the house collapses, the builder shall make compensation for all that has been ruined, and inasmuch as he did not construct properly this house which he built and it fell, he shall re-erect the house from his own means at his own expense. So those are the highlights of the Code of Hammurabi. Like I said, there's a lot of killing going on, at least a lot of threats of it to keep people in line. But notice again, like I said, we talk about marriage and divorce, marrying for romance. We talk about witches and sorcerers, but then we also talk about, you know, like I said, physicians' malpractice, construction, bad constructions, and so on. So it covers a lot of ground. It's only, you know, like I said, 200 or 300 lines. It's nothing compared to, like, say, our tax code, but it was an early version of an attempt at a comprehensive code by which you could live your life, at least if you're under the reign of King Hammurabi. And that's the Code of Hammurabi. Hope you enjoyed it. Questions or comments, always fire them away. Talk to you later.